Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special brief episode of You Should See the Other Guy. I am Jennifer, in conversation with Jennifer, myself, about the season finale of The White Lotus Season 2. And I think Sadie is actually planning to binge White Lotus Season 2 and discuss it with me later as well, which I am looking immensely forward to because I cannot wait to hear that sweet, sweet Sadie rage about some of the horrible characters in this show, particularly Cameron. So I guess that's where we'll jump in and start there. I'm not going to spend a lot of time doing recapping. Spoilers alert, spoilers ahoy everywhere. This is just my reactions to the finale, so I'm going to dive right in and start talking about it. So ever since Sadie said she was going to watch this, I have been dying to hear the noises of disgust she will make about Cameron, played by Theo James. Cameron is the kind of guy who makes me feel ashamed to experience sexual attraction to men. He is so loathsome. And I feel like what would you call that? A quadrangle when there's four people involved in a situation with Cameron, his wife, Daphne, his friend, frenemy, former college roommate, Ethan, and his wife, Aubrey Plaza, as Harper, that I heard a lot of talk leading into this season of the show that the first season of The White Lotus was about wealth and that this season is about sex and sexual relationships. But I think that it's so apparent and important to remember watching this show that you can't say that it's just about sex, like full stop. It's about sex set in the same world of these wealthy people at these ridiculous resorts and this toxicity that's going on with Cameron and Daphne. And so I sort of felt like the way that things shook out at the end, instead of it just being a look at these couples' relationships, it was almost like watching Ethan and Harper be initiated into the rich people's club and into their strange way that they conduct their marriage and their lives. So Cameron and Harper kissed. That was established. That's what Harper copped to Ethan when he was losing his shit, imagining that Cameron had fucked his wife. And Mike White, I watched the little interview after the episode. Mike White said that he believed that. He thinks that probably all they did was kiss. I tend to agree with that, though I think obviously they both knew that they had come up to the room for potentially more, you know, and I think that Harper's guilt that Ethan was so convinced that she was lying to him in the moment was because it was a very charged kiss, you know, or whatever was going on in those 10 minutes of making out was probably a little more intense than you could accurately call a kiss. But, you know, they didn't actually fuck the way that Ethan was seeing them in his own jealous fantasies after the fact, even if that was sort of what was in their minds at the time that they were kissing. Harper had a really rough vacation here. God, I really feel for her because Cameron is so horrible, but when she went into her Aubrey Plaza vengeance face mindset, given the circumstances that she was in, you know, feeling unwanted and angry at Ethan and also thinking that Ethan is not attracted to her, that's a very vulnerable position to be in, to that type of I want to bone you sexual energy that Cameron puts out towards everyone. Because that's what sex is for him. It's all a power play. It's all about taking what he wants and he feels entitled to everything. Do I think that Cameron knows that Daphne cheats on him? No, I do not think so. They obviously, Cameron and Daphne, maintain their marriage, their spark in this twisted, toxic little game that they play with each other, where they sort of turn the dagger of jealousy in each other, and that kind of keeps keeps them sexually involved with one another. I think that Cameron likes to play along with the little game. He made several mentions about, you know, she'll tease him about the Timothée Chalamet looking masseuse, and you know, he was asking her about the men that she had sex with in Noto, but I don't think he actually truly believes that, because I think Cameron is so egomaniacal, there's no way he would be able to put up with that. I've also seen the Wow. Let's just talk about Daphne for a second, actually. I've seen the theory going around online about how her and Cameron's oldest son is actually the biological child of her trainer, who she intimates to Harper that she is intimate with. I think Megan Fahey, it's really a shame that she was not nominated for an award for this season in comparison to everyone else. The acting was great across the board, but she had two scenes. The one when she has that conversation with Harper about whether or not something happened when something did happen. Cameron flat out fucked a sex worker and Ethan, you know, was present and taking Molly and stopped his little kiss he had with Mia, but he was there. When Daphne is giving Harper the maybe you should get yourself a trainer little talk, that was scarier than anything I have seen in a mafia movie. She sounds so, hey girl, casual, and she keeps her tone so light and bright while she is directly suggesting that Harper needs to cope with Ethan's potential infidelity by cheating herself, but in a way that could not be used to implicate her, Daphne, if it was ever repeated at all. And then she also seems to imply that her baby is the trainer's child. In a moment when she shows that picture, she also sort of throws down the stakes to Harper about this. Like, it was like an admission, but also a threat. Like showing her children in that moment that obviously Daphne's not going to do anything that's going to rattle the sanctity of, well, the sanctity, if that's a word you can use here, that's going to rattle the stability of her marriage. She's committed to this. She has children with Cameron and she likes the wealthy lifestyle that they live, and she's not going to challenge that directly. She challenges it in her own ways because, as she says, she is not a victim. She does whatever she feels she needs to do to feel like she is getting one back over on Cameron and is not the underdog in the situation. And as a character, she is terrifying. I would really love if they have a continuing character, like Tanya, was this season of The White Lotus to lead us from season one into season two, being the only recurring character. I would love to see Daphne again. Do I think that Daphne and Ethan fucked each other on the little island after Ethan has his talk with her? That was Megan Fahey's other incredible scene when Ethan is not wanting to be completely forthright with her about what he suspects went down with Cameron and Harper. But she directly asks him, and he has to say, I think something happened. And the acting with her eyeballs that woman did in that moment was amazing. You see the information hit her that it hurts. I was suspecting at the beginning of the season that would be a breaking point for Daphne. Any involvement between Cameron and Harper. I thought that Daphne was able to compartmentalize and have some sort of acceptance about Cameron's infidelities with people, with like Lucia, with the sex worker, with people who are casually connected, and there's not going to be any, overlap with real life there. I thought that Daphne would not take it as well in air quotes there, if Cameron got involved with the wife of a friend or someone in their social circle who's sort of on Daphne's, level social rank-wise. But the way that she reacted when Ethan told her that something happened between Cameron and Harper told us, the viewers, that this is not Daphne's first rodeo. And of course it wouldn't be. Cameron, his whole way of, he tries to exert dominance on everyone around him by, making women succumb to him, making his friends into jealous cuckolds, that's just what Cameron's gonna do. And in Daphne's mind, in the episode when she and Harper stayed in Noto, she said that Cameron is naughty like a little boy is naughty. He's not, a psychopath like these people he works with. And she has kind of come to terms with this. She knows the man she married and she obviously cares about him. But that doesn't mean that she is not going to sin in the same way, I guess. You know, she's going to actively feel like she gets some tit for tat, you know, tallying up a behavior against him. So it seemed very obvious that she was inviting Ethan to something else besides just walking over to see the old building on the island. And that was a really beautiful scene when she's looking back at him when they're walking over there. But then the show just leaves it completely up in the air as to whether anything actually happened or not. I suspect that something did happen. I don't know if you want to get into specific sex acts-wise, what exactly went down with them. But I have the feeling that Daphne made sure that she had an orgasm that came from Ethan, and that somehow gave him enough, he was calm when he was back with Harper again, though clearly they hadn't spoken about what happened and they didn't, you know, they hadn't come to a resolution about where they were going to be at after this trip. But he kind of had his dignity back when dealing with Cameron. And again, what an eerie tone to their final scene where they meet up for dinner. Harper and Ethan are trying to eat alone and get away from Cameron and Daphne for a while. But of course, they see them in the restaurant and come over to their table. And again, such an emphasis that this is absolutely business as usual for Cameron and Daphne. This is how they live their lives. And that Ethan and Harper are not the first couple something like this has probably happened with, and they're not going to be the last. Though to Ethan and Harper, this was an absolutely, earth-shaking, foundation, paradigm-changing experience. Not necessarily in a good way. Although their sex life does get to popping off again. Ethan, after whatever happened with Daphne, after his jealousy about Cameron being interested in Harper, decides that he wants to interact sexually with a real person instead of just his porn, and he wants his wife. And on the way out, when they're all waiting at the airport, Cameron and Daphne are sitting together, Ethan and Harper together as well. They're all separate, but they're both coupled up, very, very lovey with each other. And that's how Cameron and Daphne were on the trip in, when Harper thought that it was just an act, a front, and they were being performative. I think that Harper did get something about the heart of the matter there, thinking it was a front when she said it was a front, in that it's not necessarily just an accurate representation of how Cameron and Daphne are. It's not their totality, you know? They're not all lovey-dovey because they're just completely wrapped up in each other still after years and years of marriage, and this is just the way they are for each other. But because Cameron and Daphne constantly play these fucked up games with each other that keep them in, like, always in a state of making back up, I suppose. Don't know that that's a sustainable way to live your life, and that might get really, really messy for them when things eventually reach a breaking point a few decades down the line. And I think that sort of leads me into thinking about another group of our travelers, the three generations of the DeGrasso family, Bert, Dominic, and Albie. Dominic, Michael Imperioli, he is a mess. He is, you know, what? He's got 15 years or so on Cameron and company, maybe 20 years. He's a little bit in the future. And I saw somebody online speculating that the pairings of Portia and Albie, Dominic and his unseen wife, who didn't come on the trip because he just got caught cheating on her again, and Greg and Tanya are sort of stages of looking at the same marriage at different phases of life. I thought that was an interesting idea. I don't know that it particularly resonates with me. I tend to see Dominic, with his years on the couples that we just spoke about a moment ago, sort of as a midpoint of Cameron and Ethan's marriages. Dominic wants to have a marriage. He lives his marriage like Cameron does, in that he feels very entitled to what he wants and he cheats on his wife all the time. But Dominic married a woman, Albie's mother, who is more like a Harper, who he talks about, well, speaking about her to Albie, that she is a career woman. She's impressive. She's, her own person. But there's no sort of reconciliation there in the way that Cameron and Daphne have found to work out their marriage, and that Ethan and Harper are, you know, honestly maybe coming back together, bonding over the trauma of this trip. I'm not certain how happy Ethan and Harper will stay with each other years down the line. But Dominic sort of tried to take a Harper who didn't have the advice of a Daphne to talk to and treat her like a Daphne, and that's why his marriage has fallen apart. Bert and Albie, of course, are... Bert is irritating. That actor was really great. I think that he got a lot of good moments in, and I loved watching the little behind-the-scenes interviews on HBO Max. They would pair up two of the characters for each episode until the finale to talk to each other about the show and answer some questions and whatnot, and I really enjoyed the actor who played Bert in that part, the way he was able to speak with such intelligence and compassion about his character, who frankly is an irritating man. I enjoyed that a lot. But I did think that that line they gave him in the finale about Achilles Cox was cheesy and overwrought and, you know, putting a bow on the right on the nose of the what they were trying to say there. So I kind of thought that was a little goofy, even though he has been nominated for an award since. So good for him. Albie is a product of our time, and also he's, you know, directly rebelling against his father and his grandfather and the way they act. But he was a huge mark for Lucia. So of course, the sex workers, Lucia and Mia wasn't a sex worker at the start of the week, but apparently a lot can happen in 7 days at a White Lotus. Lucia was on the property because Dominic had hired her to be his girlfriend for the week, basically. But then he has a crisis of conscience 2 days in, you know, because of the because of the position he's in and because he thinks he wants to get his life with his wife back together. But he's let Lucia into the hotel now. She's got access, like a vampire invited into your house, you know. She can take whatever else she can grab while she's on the grounds of the White Lotus. And Albie is such a nincompoop. I mean, bless his heart. I wish for him that he had met a nice girl at Stanford and then just gone ahead and settled down, because he's not really in a particularly great state now. But I don't think anything is going to change appreciably for any of the DeGrasso men when they go back home to California from staying in Sicily. Their presence there could have been transformative on this vacation. You know, there was a possibility for Dom and Albie to actually have that conversation. Dom could have stopped things. Oh, I guess it would have been awkward because Albie and Lucia had already been together by then. But Dom could have come clean to his son about what Lucia was even doing there. He could have protected him, you know, from being grifted if he had been a little more honest. But Albie and Dominic have a conversation where Lucia's talked Albie into thinking that she's got like a nasty pimp coming after her for money and she needs 50,000K to be able to get away safely. And Albie, of course, even as his dad tells him, Albie, like, how are you going to get along in life if you're such a mark? Well, when Albie turns the conversation around to Dominic and says, like, well, I'll put in a good word for you with mom if you'll do this. Think of it as your karmic payment. Who's the mark now? Dominic loves that idea. You see it come over his face of a karmic payment. And, you know, that's what he's going to do. He gives $50,000, which apparently is nothing to him, which is life-changing money to most of us, Lucia included. And then he feels satisfied with himself. In the airport line, while the three men, while Albie, Dominic, and Bert are waiting to deal with their luggage or tickets or something, they all watch, a young, attractive woman walk by. And Dominic literally doesn't just turn his head, turns his whole fucking body around to watch her pass as she goes. My guy, you think you're going to go home and fix things up with your wife who has the voice of Laura Dern, and you're still staring at 23-year-olds who walk by you in the airport like that? No. He's going to go home and continue to fuck up his marriage, but he leaves on a high note about it because Albie's gotten him to buy into this idea of a karmic payment, and that somehow he's off the hook. You know, he's headed back to a good place. Albie and Portia. Wow, their meetup. I saw a meme about that saying Portia and Albie walking out of the airport, and it had that clown shoe squeaking caption on it. And yeah, that really kind of lines up for both of them. They were both so dazzled by what they thought was a genuine connection with somebody who had other motivations, both with sex workers who were obligated to other ideas. And oh, Portia, she begins her trip complaining about how you can't get away from anything because of technology and the apps and whatnot. And Albie jokingly encourages her to throw her phone away in the ocean. Obviously, she doesn't. She has it with her the whole time. But then she's right to freak out when her phone mysteriously disappears and she can't get in touch with Tanya, who has been abducted by the Palermo gays, presumably with the intention of murder. And, a neat little bit of narrative writing, but agonizing to watch as Portia slowly realizes what's going on as her initially stated desire for an adventure actually starts to come to fruition, and she realizes that she is in a frightening and dangerous situation. Painful. I thought the interactions between Portia and Jack as things started to come clean were also interesting. Jack is coming from a position where clearly he had been in such dire straits that now, you know, he's working as a sex worker and, gosh, I guess henchman, is that what you can describe what he's doing with Portia for Quentin? But he's not very good at it, and he's not very smart. He was great at the initial stage of seducing Portia, of, you know, getting her interested in him and having a good time and, you know, like having a dalliance. But then when he's tasked with getting her out of the way for a couple days so that, you know, something dire is planned for Tanya while she's gone, he kind of blows it on the first day. His guilt sort of overwhelms him, and instead of focusing on Portia and trying to keep her happy and content with whatever is going on in the moment and just keeping her distracted, which was presumably possible, he gets guilty and he gets hammered and talks too much to her and, you know, kind of gives the game away. Not that Portia's any smarter. She waits until she is alone in a car with no phone with her kidnapper before confronting him about said kidnapping. That was actually the most frightened that I was watching the whole season. I was really worried Portia was about to get sex trafficked or something when we heard the noises at the airport. Fortunately, Jack, kind of at his core, he's a guy who doesn't do good things, and he's a guy wrapped up in some really shady situations, but he's not a murderer. He, you know, he drops Portia back at the airport, where she puts on the most hideous hat that she has worn all season, and is going to flee the country without finding out that her boss is now dead. Amazing. Also, I've seen a lot of people talking about Portia's eclectic style and how hideous and what an affront to aesthetic she is. And wow, you know, people tell me that I am stylish, like on a fairly regular basis, but maybe they don't actually think that because I enjoyed a lot of what Portia wore, especially when she did that little look with the space buns where she had to use like 75 little hair clips to keep it up in the back. That was super cute. Tanya, wow. So Samantha and I talked a little bit about Tanya while we were recording our last episode about this before the finale came out. Horrible person, incredibly entertaining TV character, and Jennifer Coolidge plays her to perfection. And I ended up being really satisfied with the way that they sent her out this season. Like Samantha said, she thought it would be, you know, it's going to start getting suspicious if Tanya lives forever and continues to visit resorts where a murder happens each time, you know? And I think that it was best to not wear us out too much on Tanya, you know? She's such a rich dish. You know, you can't overindulge on it. But her finale was funny and tragic and gave us the, you know, sort of the Italian opera that was hinted at throughout, you know, her storyline this season. So she's convinced that Quentin and the sinister gaze of Palermo finally are, she's finally become convinced that they are trying to kill her on behalf of her shitty husband, Greg, who will not get anything if they divorce because of the prenup, but will apparently stand to inherit her $500 million if she dies. Like a lot of the threads that were wrapped up this season, sort of the Ethan and Daphne, did they, didn't they, like what happened, there were several things that were explicitly left unanswered. And one of those questions was, were the gays even trying to murder Tanya? I mean, presumably they were up to no good. The mafia boy toy who they had enlisted to send her out alone on the boat with had a bag full of rope and duct tape and a gun and whatnot. It wasn't looking good. But you have to wonder, are they just that theatrical? Like, is Quentin that committed to the bit that he hosts this woman for several days and you know, gives her every luxury imaginable before just sending her out to be shot between his yacht and the hotel at which she's been staying? That doesn't seem to make sense. I saw another theory thinking that maybe they were attempting to blackmail her, that they wanted to scare her for some reason. You know, well, obviously Quentin is connected with Greg. Tanya found the old picture. I would assume that that's the reason, is Greg's involvement here. But you really don't know. Were they going to kill her? I'm glad that she didn't go along, you know, and have her death dictated to her by someone else. But when the time comes for Tanya to be put in the boat, she runs into the bedroom, she escapes and gets the bag, you know, the presumable kill bag that's meant for her, locks herself into a bedroom really quickly and finds the gun. Oh, and y'all, they break in the room after her. She shoots, you know, her would-be murderer. She goes out in this amazing sequence where she's crying, her eyes are closed, she's just firing the gun in front of her as she walks out through the yacht. I was screaming, Tanya, don't waste the whole clip. You only have a limited amount of bullets. And then when we get out to the main area, wow, you see that Tanya didn't waste those bullets. Well, I mean, they all landed in a body. She murdered some gays. And then her question to dying Quentin on the floor is just, is Greg having an affair? It's, you know, finally penetrating the density of Tanya that that Greg might not be entirely faithful at this point, before Quentin blurps out a, you know, a mouthful of blood from his punctured lung in reply. And then, relatively safe, you know, she sort of indirectly kills another one of the gays as he dives off the boat to safety. I'm not certain if he was able to swim all the way back to the hotel from that distance. And the captain, Tommaso, himself apparently also gay, as he assures Tanya in his Italian, as he doesn't speak English, he escaped to the top of the boat. But Tanya has never had to take care of herself in any way in her entire life, and it doesn't even occur to her to look for the ladder that, you know, goes down the back of the boat to lead to that, or goes down the back of the yacht to lead to the boat to escape. So she tries to jump like she's a video game character from the yacht to the boat, misses, hits the water, and dies. And then there are some really beautiful scenes of, you know, her corpse floating back towards the White Lotus Resort to find its final resting place. Tanya. So the happy endings this season, that was actually a very welcome change from season one, were that the staff and the hospitality crew, the sex workers, or with the exception of Jack, I suppose, who was tied up with the gays and the mafia, the Valentina, Lucia, and Mia all end up with relatively happy endings. And Valentina, our sort of intense, slightly hanging onto the hinges, gay resort manager of this season, ends up having a sexual awakening with Mia, who, you know, wants to be put in place as the pianist and singer at the hotel. And they kind of come to an understanding by the end of it. Valentina fires the, you know, the old guy who was the previous musician and who had wanted to be able to hire Mia before, and puts Mia in his place. Mia makes it very clear to Valentina that they are, the two of them are not involved in a romance, that Valentina needs to find herself a real lesbian, but with a promise that she and Lucia know a lot of hot lesbians and are going to take Valentina to the club. Valentina's face is so amazing. I follow this girl who makes puppets, like custom puppets on Instagram. And I have been waiting with bated breath. She posted last week that she's going to make a puppet of one of the White Lotus season 2 characters to celebrate the ending of the finale. I'm imagining that it's going to have to be Tanya. You know, she was the star of the season. But I would love to see Sabrina Impacatore's face, Valentina's face, rendered as a puppet. Like, God, I could watch her all day. She was incredible. If you're not into the show for anything else, I would recommend just binging it and fast-forwarding through to Valentina's seasons just so you can watch her facial expressions. Mia, for her part, is the one who I think actually holds the award for worst style of the season over Portia. She starts out dressed, you know, kind of like your girl next door. And as Mia gets farther into her world of, you know, using her sex appeal to get what she wants and she starts getting money for it, she spends the money on the clothing she wears. But it all looks so costumey and ridiculous. She looks like a little girl playing at an adult role, you know, and even in the final scene, the matching eyeshadow she's wearing as she plays the piano when the former, you know, old piano creep comes in before Valentina fires him. God, she looks awful, but somehow sort of pulls it off because the actress playing her is very beautiful. So I thought that was just really fun to watch. And then Lucia and Mia. Lucia gets her $50,000. She leaves Albie sleeping in the dark and slips away, her week of work finished. And then we see at the end, of course, the guy who was her scary, intimidating pimp coming after her for the money is actually a friend, looks to be like a valet, a doorman who works at another hotel nearby in town. And Lucia and Mia are dressed up in cute outfits and walking down the cobblestone streets and living their best life. And after season one, which more realistically showed all the rich people leaving and going back to their own lives at home while the lives of the staff were either ended or, you know, left in disappointment and shambles, it was kind of a nice reversal to see the hospitality crew walking out of the season on an upbeat note. While our guests, while they might not actually suffer consequences, you know, in the way that us non-extremely wealthy people would conceive of that, they definitely had a different experience. I'm looking immensely forward to season 3. I can't wait to see where they take it next. And I really do hope that they have one character carry over, sort of like Tanya did in this one, to lead us into the next. I'm not really particularly interested in the mystery of Greg anymore and whether he had actually hired Quentin and company to murder Tanya or whether Tanya's death now is a happy accident for him, as I guess he will inherit that money. But I'm bored with him. I want more ridiculous, over-the-top women characters, and this show does deliver that in spades. Looking forward to the future, and also looking forward to discussing this again with Sadie as she watches. I think that Sadie and I maybe need to do a bonus episode where we just talk for 30 minutes straight about how horrible the character of Cameron Sullivan is. That could be fun. Anyway, I guess that's it. I've talked it out. Love y'all. See ya on the next regular episode of You Should See the Other Guy. Bye.